They subject criminal sanctions on people that are unable to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. All of the statutes require that the mental disease or defect be so extreme that it completely eradicates the mental element of the crime, if there is a mental element defined in the crime. This was one of the problems for the psychiatrists previously when they were discussing the issue of McNaughton. They said even in the most severe cases of schizophrenia, the person does not have absolutely no conception, in very few cases at least, no conception of what he or she is doing. You're eradicating, as Dr. Bloom has said, you're eradicating the defense in effect when you start requiring complete absence of the cognitive element, especially in conjunction with an absence of volitional as a defense, or you're forcing people to say things that perhaps they wouldn't say in all candor if that were not the test. We submit a quantum leap back into the quagmire that the American Law Institute sought to get us out of. All of the bills remove the defense for misdemeanor property crimes, kleptomania. That person will go to the county jail. And those that would say, that person will be put on probation, very likely so the first time, maybe even the second time. But perforce, by nature of the particular condition, kleptomania being a cyclically kind of thing, not getting any treatment, constantly getting into new problems, they're going to find themselves in the Marion County Jail here in this particular county, and they're not going to get any treatment whatsoever. Not to mention the kind of effect it's going to have impacting the Marion County Jail. And the victimized position this places some very weak kinds of people in terms of the kinds of other criminals that we have, or kinds of criminals, not other criminals, but the kinds of criminals that one finds in these other penal institutions. Specific comments to specific bills, HB 2075. The last version I saw contemplates a not guilty plea for the person that establishes the defense. That, I think, is a mistake. Because it anticipates the person would simply walk out the door. The present system is that if a person provides or is successful in the defense and establishes the lack of responsibility, there is a hearing to determine whether or not they are dangerous and whether or not they should be committed to the custody of PSRB. My understanding of Bill 2075 is that they'd walk out the door. In some counties, I think that would be a problem. Because the civil commitment process for some very dangerous people would not be quick enough to capture them. They'll drop out of sight, perhaps commit other acts that could be prevented by not allowing the person to walk out the door in the first instance. Under HB 2075, if the person is guilty, there is a hearing to determine whether or not the person lacks the capacity to appreciate criminality, but it fails to allocate who has the burden of proof. Who's got to prove the lack of capacity? Is it the prosecution? Is it the defense attorney? A very important point that ought to be addressed. Finally, with 2075, relating to the specially designated offenses, it's my understanding there's been an amendment that would not cause a transfer of people from the authority of the PSRB to corrections after they have been discharged from PSRB. I think that if that's the case, that solves that defect, in my opinion. If not, it's still a defect. With respect to 2269, that also shifts PSRB, custody from PSRB to Corrections Division, and it's inadequate, we feel, for the same reason. With respect to 2892, we find that there is only a hearing given for those who are found not guilty due to mental disease or due only to mental disease or defect. So in other words, a person pleads guilty, saves the system all of the trouble and expense of going through a trial. That person doesn't get a hearing at all. Now, what does that say to me as a defense attorney that in a situation in which I find my client may have a good mental disease or defect, am I going to go in and plead him guilty under 2892? Absolutely not. I'm going to put the system into operation and try to prove my mental disease or defect to a jury, because if I succeed under 2892, then I get a dispositional hearing and get them into the treatment phase or mode afterwards. I think that's a serious defect of 2892. There's other areas of expressed concern by the District Attorney's Association about the front-end expenses, and I'm talking about those expenses to get the person evaluated initially to determine whether or not your client has a mental disease or defect. under the present statute or any other statute. I think we will find, if it's empirically studied, that it's relatively inexpensive for such exams, in the neighborhood of $150 to $300. You have to compare that with the cost of post-conviction relief cases if the defense attorney does not do it and the person feels that he or she did have a mental disease or defect. They're going to file a petition in the circuit court. They're going to get appointed counsel. That attorney who's going to be alleging that the prior attorney didn't get a mental disease or defect exam is going to get one. It's going to be paid for at that point in time. It's going to go to trial and maybe an appeal. I think you compare those costs with the cost of that front-end report and decide whether or not you're cost-effective in removing these people out of the system. Then the complaint about the total cost for the celebrated case, and that's true. Thousands of dollars are spent on psychiatric testimony and evidence for these celebrated cases. But to my understanding, Patty Hearst did not have her psychiatric expenses paid by the public. That was privately incurred, celebrated case. John Hinckley, my understanding is, did not have that paid by the public. It was paid by his family. So we have two kinds of cases, and to put it on the other side, Larry Moore did have his, my understanding is, did have his expenses paid by the public. So we find two categories of celebrated cases that generate tremendous costs and psychiatric expenses, some of which are paid for by private funds, by the families and whatever associations that can afford them. Those that come out of the public expense, the public fund, I submit to you are true psychiatric defense cases, ones that would have to constitutionally proceed by way of a plea of mental disease or defect and to be litigated. Some of those will succeed. Our experience statistically is that most of them will not. But it would be, I submit, unconstitutional in terms of one's Sixth Amendment right to counsel under the federal constitution, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, not to explore the adequacy of that person's mental capabilities at the time of the act in question. There's the final statement that psychiatrists want change, and I have before me the paper that's been referred to. It's the white paper of the American Psychiatric Association, December 1982, and we find that they don't eliminate the volitional element. They say that the insanity defense should be retained in some form. The insanity defense rests upon the fundamental premise of the criminal law that punishment for wrongful deeds should be predicated upon moral culpability. However, within the framework of English and American law, defendants who lack the ability or capacity to rationally control their behavior do not possess free will. Therefore, they cannot be said to have chosen to do wrong. Therefore, they should not be punished or handled similarly to all other criminal defendants. Retention of the insanity defense is essential to the moral integrity of the criminal law. However, I have to submit that the psychiatrists waffle a little bit towards the end, because they say later on that it's harder for us to tell the jury, at least explain to the jury, how the person was unable to conform their conduct to the requirements law. It's easier for us as psychiatrists to say that the person could or could not appreciate the criminality of the conduct. It's harder, they say, for the jurors, and that's their words, not mine, the jurors to understand what they're saying about volition. They don't say it's harder for them to say something about it. And they say that complaint is made by many psychiatrists, but they don't say whether that's most, a large minority, or what the case might be. They find no merit at all in a plea of guilty but mentally ill. It's kind of surprising to me that the PSRB takes the position that you ought to consider a guilty but mentally ill verdict. The American Psychiatric Association quite clearly says no, that is not appropriate, and they go on for a number of paragraphs to explain why. I would also submit to you that if the reasoning of the PSRB were correct, that what you need to do is get these people to say, I'm guilty, to get them into a proper frame of mind for some kind of treatment, I would say that I find that questionable. If you went out at the present moment to the Oregon State Penitentiary and you stopped the first random 500 or 600 people there and say to these people, are you guilty? I would submit to you that 95 to 100% of them would say, no, of course not. They have been adjudicated guilty. They have that record that says you are guilty. They don't accept responsibility for it. To expect people that have a mental disease or defect to do better than these people that do not have a mental disease or defect in terms of admitting guilt, I find questionable. I don't think a slip of paper telling these people that they're guilty would simply open up broad avenues of treatment that don't already exist. Um, In conclusion, I think that we have an excellent standard now. You know, sometimes the most difficult course of action is inaction. And I guess that's what we're proposing, that the matter be thoroughly explored, where we are, where we've been, where we should be going, and then consider whether or not we want to put aside all that was done in coming up with the ALI formulation and strike off into new areas on our own. We feel that the test is a compromise already in the extremes that existed, that with the experience with the PSRB here in Oregon, and also the aspect of the affirmative burden of proof on the defendant here in Oregon, which is not the case in many jurisdictions, that we have a good, complete system for handling these kinds of problems in our system of criminal jurisprudence. We avoid the pitfalls that exist in many instances. We should not allow the John Hinckleys of the world to dictate what course Anglo jurisprudence should take in the foreseeable future. No matter how rehabilitative we try to make the prison setting, there is still, in the last analysis, a punitive element to it and a stigma of having been adjudicated a criminal. Thank you.
My name is Emily Simon. I'm the Chief Misdemeanor Attorney for the Metropolitan Public Defender, and I'm here because I have one large concern with all three bills, and that is that it seeks to do away with the not guilty by reason of insanity defense for the dispositional phases to all misdemeanors not involving physical injury or threat of physical injury. I would point out to the members of the committee that this is completely unnecessary to do, and that 2 years ago the legislature took care of this problem by enacting ORS 161328, which provides that where a person who would otherwise be not guilty by reason of insanity and the crime does not involve a risk of personal injury can then be referred to the civil commitment proceedings by the trial court judge. I would also point out to the members of the committee that for an attorney to raise an NGI in a case of a misdemeanor, they have to be almost as nuts as the client. And for that reason, we would point out to the court, excuse me, to the members of the committee, that only 13 NGIs have been raised out of 6,000 misdemeanor cases that have been handled by the Metropolitan Public Defender since July of 1979, and that comes out to less than 0.002%. And the reason is because your client is going to do 1,000 times worse being shoved under the jurisdiction of the PSRB for a year and probably in effect incarcerated than if they were found guilty by a trial court or guilty by a jury and even sentenced to the maximum period of time at Rocky Butte, because they'd be out in 5 months and 21 days, probably less time, probably sent over to MCCF. But the only time that I would ever do it or advise somebody to do it is when your client is so completely bonkers that you know that they're going to be preyed upon in the jail. And that creates all kinds of problems. It creates problems for jail securities, and it creates problems for your poor client, who in my case, I've had women, and there seem to be a preponderance of women, misdemeanants, who are referred to the PSRB. It's inexplicable, but they're there. I've had women who've come through the jail system after having six or seven. They've been picked up on shoplifts. I have one particular client who can't tell the difference between when she runs out of her medication, what a Tylenol bottle is, and how her medication looks, so she just sweeps it off the shelf and gets picked up for shoplifting. Well, after about the eighth time, she was taken to jail, and when it came time for her trial date, she had cigarette burns all over her because she just couldn't defend herself. I've had other male clients who've had much worse things done to them in the jails because they can't defend themselves, and this creates all kinds of problems. I think that the result would be, without a not guilty by reason of insanity defense for misdemeanors, that I would be in the position of advising my clients to take every single thing I could to trial, because it's going to be much better for them to be walking out the door, especially where we're no longer going to have the thing to turn them into a civil commitment case, than for them to be subject to what's going to happen to them in jail. And I think that this is particularly true, and I'm responding to a statement that I heard today by the PSRB. I think this is particularly true as to retarded citizens. And I think that it's the retarded citizens here that we're really talking about. for the individuals who can appreciate what they're doing, well, then perhaps, and as a defense lawyer, I would question this, if Rocky Butte or a penal institution is the proper place. But it's certainly not for somebody who's retarded where they'll get no treatment at all. And if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I've received a request from Mr. Mike Bailey, who I understand is the Multnomah County public defender, if he could testify at this point, as he has some statistics. I guess they're that deal directly with what we've been talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some material I'd like to present to the committee in written form. This is just a statistical analysis. I think can help on your understanding of the earlier OCDLA testimony. Be very brief. My only time. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I have done is to pull statistics from two fiscal years from our felony section in the Multnomah County office. It shows that we handled 6,056 felony cases in that two-year period, of which 53 resulted in not guilty by mental disease or defect. That's about 35% of our total not guilty, or 30% of total not guilty findings, but 0.08% of the total felony caseload, a very small amount. The rest of the paper that I have prepared for you shows I pulled the files on all the cases from the 1981-82 fiscal year and 82-83 to date. That was 23 times the defense was asserted, 24 times it was used, it was successful every time. In one case, State v. Jerry Peterson, which is discussed on page 16 of my memo, the deputy district attorney raised the defense at trial over the objection of the defense attorney. That issue is on appeal. We're hopeful that Judge Johnson will be spoken to clearly by the Court of Appeals on the appropriateness of defense attorneys raising defenses at trial over the defendant's objection. The conclusions that I bring to your attention from this is that there is not one case in which there was a significant disagreement between experts. In 23 cases, we had expert witnesses appointed. In only 7 cases, the government had expert witnesses appointed. Of those 7 of the state, in the one case, German Nasser, discussed on page 15, both the defense and state experts were inconclusive. Judge R.E. Jones found the person not responsible. In all the other cases, the government either stipulated to the defense expert testimony by report, or their experts agreed. So our experience has been that we do not have these battles of the shrinks. In not one of these cases was there a trial. Not one case was a witness call, except for Jerry Peterson, which was a case that we didn't even intend to have. So rather than being expensive, they've actually been very time and money saving cases. They've all been extremely obvious. One case I would like you to look at on page 19 and 20 because it raises an interesting issue, and that is the case of Ricardo Ruiz. This is a case which started out with a bank robbery in a federally protected institution. I assume it was a bank or some kind of savings and loan. So the FBI was involved. Very clearly, Mr. Ruiz was nuts. As you know, under federal law, there is no provision after you've been found not guilty by mental disease or defect for any treatment. The only reason John Hinckley is in an institution is because of a law peculiar to the District of Columbia. If that result had happened in the U.S. District Court in Oregon, he would simply have walked. So very, not real often, but not unusually, cases in which the person is not responsible are transferred from federal jurisdiction and prosecuted as state cases because of the PSRB resource and the ability to follow these people up with post-verdict supervision. And that's what happened with Ruiz. I did it myself a number of occasions when I was a prosecutor. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. The other thing I've done here is to compute the parole matrix for these individuals, given their prior criminal history, as near as I can determine it from our files, and contrasted it with the PSRB sentence that they incurred. In each case, the PSRB jurisdiction is substantially longer than what would have happened to them if they'd been sent to the corrections.
Thank you, Michael. Questions at this time? We may have some after we've had a chance to review your material, and we will.
I'll be happy to come back in touch with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Jeffrey Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Rogers. I'm a lawyer. I've worked as a trial lawyer in the public defender's office, in federal prosecutor's office, and in private practice. I'm also part-time the faculty of the Department of Psychiatry at the Oregon Health Sciences University. I was former chair of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I've studied this issue of insanity defense along with Dr. Bloom and Dr. Manson for some years now, and prior to that, studied it in other capacities since 1975. I find myself somewhere in the middle of the positions that have been expressed today. I think there is room for some refinements and some changes, and I'll address those in a second. But let me start where almost everyone else has started, and I think where you will find just about everybody starting. That is, the system is working well. I've handed out a two-page questionnaire, which I think is of some interest, I don't think you've seen before, that tabulates the responses received by the Psychiatric Security Review Board from district attorneys, from deputy DAs. And you will see on that questionnaire, the two-page one, which is separate from my testimony, that without exception, the district attorneys, when asked directly, the deputy district attorneys agree that the PSRB has been doing either a good or an excellent job. Without exception, agree that the PSRB decisions on dangerousness and on mental disease or defect are appropriate, and so forth. It's quite a ringing endorsement of the PSRB by deputy DAs, and it does strike me as somewhat strange to contrast that with the official position being taken by the District Attorneys Association, and also to contrast the position of the District Attorneys Association with the day-to-day cooperation provided by the district attorneys in this system. I have provided to your counsel a paper which analyzes in more detail this fact that you've heard so many times, that 85% or so of the successful cases are agreed to by the prosecution. If anyone is interested in reviewing exactly what that's all about, I think that paper prepared by Dr. Bloom and Dr. Manson and myself will help to elaborate that. But it again shows that this system, the insanity defense system, is generally run by consensus in this state. And the information that Mr. Bailey just provided to you is very interesting and certainly is consistent with our review of the overall situation throughout the state. I think what he pointed out about the prosecutors actually using the insanity defense on occasion is very important. Prosecutors sometimes nowadays use it as a tool for themselves to have it raised over the objection of the defendant because they know it will result in more security. So my next major point is, I urge you to ask, where are the problems? It's been fascinating to follow this over the years since 1975. Everybody keeps wanting to change things because of this pressure about the insanity defense, but in that period of time, nobody has been able to point to actual problems, to specifics, to case problems, to examples where the thing is not working. So if you had a choice in this session between changing things radically and doing nothing, I think you would be much better off doing nothing. There's been so much conflicting opinions given. There are very few conflicting facts. The facts speak for themselves. The system's working well. If you chose to do nothing, the world would be safe in Oregon for the next 2 years until you did something then. If you chose to do great drastic changes, I think you risk some real backfires. And one final basic question before I go through my testimony briefly is, I'm wondering whether people really are intending to increase or decrease the number of people using the insanity defense. We've heard both positions. Representative Courtney has pointed out think accurately, that juries are very reluctant to accept the defense. And for instance, in the Lawrence Moore case, that probably some would say should have been a verdict of not responsible. Therefore, if you put it in the sentencing stage, those kinds of cases will be found not responsible. That would increase the numbers. Other people want to decrease the numbers by cutting back on the leeway that the test gives to people to raise. Do you really want to increase or decrease, or in fact, does the present system pick out about the right number of people, about 80, 85 people per year in the entire state? I suggest the current system does a pretty good job of picking out those severely mentally ill people that Dr. Bloom talked about who should be dealt with differently. Turning to the testimony, and I've outlined it in written form and handed it out to you with my suggestions, there are really three areas of change that I would suggest. And they address what I see as the three problems which do exist. One is the public concern about this defense, and I've attached a cartoon there to my testimony, which I think does reflect something about the public's attitude about insanity-type defenses. I suggest that the answer to the public's concern is to change the name, and I've proposed in summary form and in the statute form the name I would utilize: guilty except legally insane. Secondly, I think defining mental disease or defect would be appropriate, and I've suggested some language to do that. And third, I agree with the provisions, the amendments that would extend the PSRB jurisdiction as proposed in House Bill 2075. I won't repeat what's in my written testimony. I will elaborate, especially in response to Representative Courtney's concerns, that I believe that removing the decision on insanity from the jury could well backfire. And I am concerned that perhaps Judy Snyder's testimony was a little bit unclear in that respect. I understand from her that she too has grave doubts about removing that decision from the jury. She has no objection to changing the name, nor do I. I think that would be helpful. But I think, as Dr. Bloom testified, we risk some really bad consequences if we remove it from the jury. Similarly, I think that cutting the test in half will accomplish nothing. We don't really know what it was accomplished. I would agree with Dr. Bloom, a study for 2 years would be very helpful in that. What would perhaps eliminate those few people who are inappropriate is to define mental disease or defect, and I've given proposed language here attached to my testimony in a way I think that that could be done. It still would not eliminate disagreement on what the diagnosis is, but on those few cases where everybody agrees this is a personality disorder, it would eliminate those people. For instance, when I was on the board, we saw occasional pedophiles. All the experts would say, the only thing wrong with this person is he abuses children. He has a personality disorder, pedophilia, sexually abuses children. He's not psychotic. We can't treat him with medicine. He has no other problems. That's his only problem. But one expert would say, I think that's a mental disease or defect. The other one would say, I don't think that's a mental disease or defect. What I'm proposing here is that you say specifically in the statute that personality disorders do not qualify as legally relevant mental diseases or defects. So that in those cases where the experts do agree, and there are some, that the only thing wrong with this person is a personality disorder, that case would not make it to the review board. You would still have some disagreements about what the diagnoses are. You get those. And those cases might or might not make it to the review board. But you wouldn't have that real troublesome situation that we used to face where you had somebody before you where everybody said, this is just a personality disorder. And the board would say, well, what do you do with this guy? Is that a mental disease or defect or not? We set up a few cases for the appellate court. We would have testimony. You agree on the diagnosis? Yes. Do you agree on the diagnosis? Yes. Is it a mental disease or defect? Yes. Mental disease or defect? No. Court of Appeals tell us, is it or isn't it? Court of Appeals affirms without opinion. Leaves us in, you know, in a bind. I say, let's go ahead and define it as we have been suggesting for some years and say, if it's a personality disorder, it doesn't qualify. You run some risk because you will put some of those kinds of people in the prison who might be amenable to some treatment, sex offenders and so forth. But I think it's a fairly small number, and I think it's worth doing to bring some clarity to it, and also to eliminate from the preparation for trial stage the problems that the DAs have of having to respond to the inappropriate raising of the insanity defense by a lot of personality disorders. I think that would help to address the problem that Dale Penn and others appropriately raise concerning not who gets to the PSRB, but who fiddles around with the defense and has to be defeated with it by the prosecution. So I outlined it in the testimony. I'd be glad to go over that in more detail today or Friday if it would be helpful for me to return. I think these pick out things from the three bills. That it picks out the definition of mental disease defect from the Attorney General's bill and clarifies that, but adopts it. It picks out the extension of PSRB jurisdiction from the Interim Judiciary Committee bill and supports that, and it picks out the change of the name of the verdict in a way that I think reflects exactly what's going on. The person is guilty in that they committed the act and had the culpable mental state, except they're legally insane.
Are you able to return Friday?
Yes, I am. I hope
for the consideration of the bill.
I hope to be, yes.
Okay. That'll give us a chance to read your materials along with the others that have been submitted.
I'll also say, by the way, the cartoon also points out that those are all personality disorders that are made fun of in that cartoon.
Representative Courtney? Your description of personality disorders and the experts saying it's